You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers, and good afternoon to our overseas listeners, and good morning to Peter.
Good morning, good morning.
And we're going
You went back to doing the intro the same way this week.
You mean instead of hello world?
You changed it up last week.
Oh,
I thought you were going to start off good morning Vietnam. I saw Robin Williams on Ellen DeGeneres the other day. He's so hilarious. I want to be like him when I grow up, if I grow up.
Yeah. Are we waiting or are we holding our breath for this little question?
for me to grow up? Probably not. But we're going back to our archives of material. It turns out, listeners, and you may not have known this, that there was such a lot going on in Charleston, South Carolina, at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. We still have some fascinating recordings that we made down there. And first up, an institution, shall we call him, in Southern cooking.
Louis Osteen,
and he can speak for himself.
No visit to Charleston, South Carolina would be complete without a little chat with Louis Osteen and a visit to his restaurants. Louis, how did you become the grand statesperson for Southern cuisine?
I started early, and I've done it for a long time, so I'm the oldest. It comes very naturally.
Tell us about your two restaurants.
Well, we're at the beach. We're in Pauley's Island, and we have two restaurants, Lewis's at Pauley's and the Fish Camp Bar. Lewis's at Pauley's is sort of a nod toward casual fine dining, and the Fish Camp Bar is a nod towards life at the beach.
And how old are they? I mean, they've been around for a long time?
Well, no, not a long time. We've been there for 5 years. We were in Charleston for 13 years before that, and we were at the same restaurant in Pauley's before that for 9 years.
How come there's all of a sudden this huge resurgence of interest in Southern cooking, just when everybody thinks we're going to lighten up, which you don't describe Southern cooking as lightening up. Why is everybody so mad for Southern cooking?
I can answer that. And I've thought about it for a long, long time, being the elder statesman of all this madness. It's good food. The South makes really good food. The South is a very important piece of the American canvas. The South has, if you think about it for a minute, the South has given this country all of its indigenous music. There's blues, jazz, gospel, bluegrass, country music, all comes from the South. It has given this country wonderful men of letters, men and women of letters, a lot of authors, and the great wordsmiths. And it's given this country the juiciest food. Now, maybe because of our tumultuous past, it's not a perfect place like the rest of the world, but we're making really good food, and it's full of really good people.
Are your restaurants serving a classical Southern cuisine?
No. Yes. We serve some classical things. We serve some interpretation on classical things. We serve some French things. And tonight we have a Thai dinner in the restaurant.
Oh, that sounds really great. Huh? Do you travel a lot?
As much as I can. It's a lot easier than cooking.
I agree. How about telling our listeners addresses or, best yet, a website for your restaurants?
It's a little bit tricky, but the website, and it's a good one too, is www.lewis, L-O-U-I-S-A-T, Pauley's, Pauley's.com.
Great. I want also to mention your seminal cookbook, and you also said there were a lot of others coming out. Tell us about them.
The cookbook is currently sold out, I'm proud to say, and we're negotiating right now, and in fact, we have to reprint that with some additional recipes, and we've got two more books coming out, one about Pauley's and one about the Fish Camp Bar.
The title of your original cookbook?
Louis Osteen's Charleston Cuisine.
Boy, I'm really glad to have met you. Thank you. And next time, I'm going to eat in your restaurant.
I hope you will. It'll be fun.
Well, are we going to eat there, or are we going back to Charleston?
Oh, yeah. I have his card. I mean, we're not doing it on our next trip because it won't fit.
Oh.
But we'll make it fit somehow.
All right.
We'll get there.
Okay. Now, we have another.
Another icon. Another icon of Southern cuisine, Frank Stitt, who has a wonderful restaurant called Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama.
We're taking a break from eating food and drinking wine and talking to one of the iconic chefs of Southern cooking, Frank Stitt, best known for his first restaurant opened in 1982 called the Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama. He's since opened some other restaurants, which he will tell us about. Right now, let me say hello, Frank. Thank you for talking to us.
Well, hello, and it's great to be here in Charleston with you.
How did you get to be sort of the spokesperson, the hero, and described to me as one of the best chefs in the, or the best chef, actually, in the South? How did all this happen to you?
Well, I guess I just fell in love with food at long ago in the mid-70s. And at that time, there really, Southern chefs weren't a very common commodity. And I think probably at a thing called the Salute to Southern Chefs, here held here in Charleston 15 or so years ago for a number of years, there were Emeril Lagasse, myself, Ben Barker, Louis Oldstein, were kind of a core group. But I think that I'm not exactly sure, but maybe it's part of my central location in Alabama. And actually, growing up in Alabama, in my roots of my mother's family, my grandparents, who had a wonderful farm in North Alabama with everything from mules to quail and chicken and asparagus and corn and potato sheds. And it was just this wonderful working farm. And I think that my memories of being on that farm really connected me to an almost an earlier generation of Southern cooking and Southern food.
Could you describe your three different restaurants and what they offer?
Well, certainly. With Highlands, you know, when I opened that in 1982, I had just returned from France and working with Richard Olney, who was my mentor and who was Alice Waters' mentor. She introduced me, and I was bound and determined while I was studying philosophy at UC Berkeley that I had to go to France and, if possible, work or just spend time with Richard, because I think he was the greatest writer on food and wine that I had ever experienced. He and Elizabeth David were kind of my heroes. So anyway, after returning from France, and I thought, well, maybe I want to live in the Caribbean. I went down there for a little while, but then it hit me. I don't want to live there. I like to visit. But what I could do is to bring my love of Provence, of France, and of cooking back to my home of Alabama and to start a restaurant that would weave in French technique with our Southern ingredients. And so thus, that's how Highlands has been kind of stayed true to those goals. Now, Bottega, which is just three blocks away in the most gorgeous building, it is an Italian restaurant, and it allows me to cook in an Italian way without kind of clouding my original dream of keeping Highlands true to its South and to France. And so Bottega, Bottega Cafe are just this wonderful purity and simplicity of Italian foods. But then in 2000, there was a little building right next door to Highlands that became available. And my landlord was threatening to bring in an Atlanta nightclub. So I said, well, let me take it instead. And there we created Chez Fonfon, which is a little French bistro that Patrick Dunn from New Orleans helped with the antiques. And it's just this wonderful, charming little bistro, very casual.
Well, listeners, put Birmingham, Alabama on your list of places to go if you haven't already, because everyone raves about the quality of this man's cooking as well as his integrity. You're known as a really good guy.
Well, I'm afraid I'm delighted to be known as a good guy. But, you know, if anything that maybe I'm proud of, it is a relationship that I've had with our staff that really comes from a mutual respect. And so there are half a dozen people that have been with me for 25 years. And so we are family-like in our, I think, in our relationships, in that we really try to be very sincere and genuine and to try to help people out. But we, you know, I think if you respect and are good to people, then they, you know, you get that in return.
Frank Stitt, tell us about your, I guess it's called definitive book, Frank Stitt's Southern Table, Recipes and Gracious Traditions from Highlands Bar and Grill. You said it's really a story.
Well, it is more of a narrative than it is just recipes. And it's a story of a lot of the relationships that I have with our purveyors, our farmers, our cooks, and just a little bit more of a story about the South and my memories of growing up in Alabama, time on the farm and times cooking. But the Southern Table, it's artisan is the publisher. Ann Bramson, my editor, is really one of the greatest food editors or of cookbooks in the world. And Christopher Hersheimer, the photographer. I think that it's Christopher's greatest work, and she's one of the greatest photographers I know. And so we shot it all in natural light. So everything we did was on a windowsill or on a door stoop or outside. And it really, she captured, we shot 1 week each season. And so that allowed me to cook everything that was at its peak of seasonality. And if it was autumn, it was sweet potatoes and turnip greens, and there was an autumn light to the look. And if it was spring, there was a greenness of peas and asparagus and watercress. And so all of the book is really infused with that in a wonderful way. And so it, you know, it's something that I think does capture the, our soul. And what's been interesting is just to see the response from all the people that say, well, you know, that reminds me of something that I had at my grandparents or at my father's, or it reminds me of something about the land and food. There is that spiritual connection that I think that this kind of resonates, that a way that we all share in one way or another.
Now, you also are very active in Southern Foodways, is it? Tell us about that.
That's right. Southern Foodways is my good buddy John T. Edge from the University of Mississippi in Oxford. This is really something that he kind of captained about 10 years ago. I was perhaps on the founding of it, but just as a small contributor. But now Southern Foodways is about capturing our food cultures, our histories, our traditions, our ingredients, and trying to identify them, celebrate them, to taste them, to savor them, and not let them fade away. So it may be a particular kind of a way of cooking fish on the Gulf Coast, or it may be a way of cooking greens in the foothills of the Appalachia, or it may be about Carolina gold rice. But it's a way of preserving our Southern food cultures. And it's done by oral histories. There's film. John T. Edge is just a brilliant leader, and the University of Mississippi has just been an incredible catalyst for helping this along. Just last weekend at Blackberry Farms in Tennessee, one of the great inns of America, there was the first annual kind of a tribute to Southern chefs, Southern artisans, food makers, and farmers. And so a few chefs were asked to choose their favorite farmer, their favorite producer. And so I had the folks from Snow's Bend, who are the great organic farmers that provide me with some of our produce. Ben Barker asked these people that I think it's Muddy Pond who make the best sorghum molasses. And then Louis Osteen invited Alan Benton, who makes some of the greatest hickory smoked bacon. So this is something that will continue year after year, and hopefully at Blackberry Farms, and as ways to identify and encourage more artisan producers, more small farmers to go back and to produce foods of integrity and quality and localness.
It sounds so heavenly. Can you give us a contact point, an email, or a web page where people can make reservations, get more information?
Well, certainly. We are part of Open Table at HighlandsBarnGrill.com, HighlandsRestaurant.com, and that will link you to Bottega as well. And so I hope that you will come and explore our sites there. But also in Birmingham, it's kind of a little bit of a undiscovered, wonderful small city, and it's a beautiful city, and it's a wonderful town, and there's an incredibly diverse food and restaurants, and just a great sophisticated town of people that really appreciate great restaurants, and lucky for me.
And you've talked us into it. See you there.
And now it's time to take a break.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. 412-661-6001. 6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Don't forget to check our website for all the news that's worth doing, our blog on. And,
there you go.
And as, what else?
And as my mother would say, in the next segment, we have the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker. Actually, we don't have all of those. We do have
a guest, though.
We have probably the country's most famous butcher.
Thank you very much.
Stanley Lobel. Of Lobel's Meats in New York, where he's one of the partners.
And he's going to be the spokesperson today, explaining about the family's history, the book. And this the book is called Lobel's Primetime Grilling, and it's, if you think you know, as Peter said, he thought he knew about grilling until he read this book. And talk to us about the butcher business.
Yeah, let's begin sort of at the beginning.
Yes.
Well, the beginning was a long, long, long time ago. I have both of my sons and my nephew in business with us. We're on Madison Avenue and 82nd Street for almost 55 years. I started there with my dad. My boys and my nephew are the fifth generation in the meat business.
Wow.
Five generations.
Now, do you teach them? I often wondered, how do you just pass it all down, all this knowledge that you've had in your family?
You know, it's working with the person and just getting a feel for it. I mean, there are people who take their trade very seriously and people who don't. We take our trade very, 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 very seriously. Our store is absolutely immaculate in cleanliness. And as far as product is concerned, we have the finest product available to the consumer throughout the country. We only have very, very, very high-end prime beef.
You mean we can order this to be sent?
Well, we have a mail order entity as well. It's lobels.com, L-O-B-E-L-S, no apostrophe, .com, where we ship our product throughout the continental United States. And we ship priority overnight, fresh.
So it's not even frozen.
At home, you know it hasn't been frozen for 6 months, a year, or 2 years, or whatever the case may be.
But you source from the very best places, and you hang for a long time. Tell us just a little bit about that.
When I used to go to the market with my dad many, many years ago, we used to go to two or three of our suppliers and be able to get all the product we need. The industry has changed so much, and the availability of the product, of the type of product that we use today, has become so scarce that it requires us to go to maybe 30 or 40 different places throughout the week in order to satisfy our needs. And then once we procure the product, it requires anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks of dry aging. And what the dry aging process does is it brings out the flavor and the texture in the meat. It's almost like aging a fine red wine. It creates a coating on the outside of the meat. It protects the meat on the inside. It not only does it tenderize it, but again, it brings through the flavor. And this process, of course, is quite expensive, because when you do that, you wind up losing almost a third of the piece of meat that you originally
bought. Yeah, the moisture evaporates, yeah, right?
It's not only the moisture, it's that coating, that thick coating on the outside of the meat and on the bone that you have to remove, because you don't want to taste the aging, you want to taste the flavor of the meat.
Right. I can remember, Stanley, the first time I had a real American Midwest steak. I remember where it was. It was a restaurant called Jess and Jim's. We read about it in Playboy magazine, and it was.
What are you doing reading Playboy magazine?
That was a long time ago.
Okay.
And the meat tasted different than any other beef I had ever tasted before. It was like I was eating a new food.
That's correct.
It was like eating meat I hadn't eaten before.
It's an incredible experience. The only problem with this type of product is once you eat it, you must come back for more.
Right.
And the product is not cheap, that's for sure. But I'd rather have one great steak a week than two or three lousy ones during the week.
Right.
Right.
Well, let's go on now. So how did you develop this fascination with grilling?
Well, actually, this grilling book that we have currently is our eighth cookbook that we've done. You know, we're in such a high-end business, and we have such a relationship with our clientele that we're asked on a constant basis, how do you cook this? How do you prepare that? How do you marinate? How long should this particular steak be grilled? What should you put on it for the best occurrence? What kind of hamburger should you use for the greatest hamburger on the grill? And so on and so forth. And being that most of your listeners out there, when they grill, I would assume, use a lot of hamburger. And the hamburger, the flavor of a hamburger should be exceptionally meaty and flavorful and juicy. And in order to get a hamburger like that, you need to mix a combination of chuck and hanger meat. And hanger meat is a piece of meat that hangs near the short loin in the animal, extremely flavorful, very, very, very rich. And I dare say if you had a hamburger made from that combination and grilled, the outside seared, the inside rare, when you literally put your fork in there and get ready to eat it or bite into it, you're going to get a spurt of juice that's going to be incredible.
You're making me so hungry.
Yeah, why are you making us so hungry? I'm at a page with a cowboy steak recipe on it. Cowboy steak with chipotle mayonnaise. This is a cut that we really like. Is it otherwise known as a rib steak? Is that what it's called?
That's exactly correct. A cowboy steak is cut a little bit thicker, about 2-2.5 inches, and we French the outside bone. But my preference, to be very honest with you, is not to French that outside bone, but to leave it. I mean, it makes a beautiful presentation. But you know, that's the meat on that bone is really, really, really delicious.
Yeah, sweeter at the bone, right?
The key to cooking a good steak, really, is to have a steak about 2-2.5 inches thick, whether it be a cowboy steak, a porterhouse steak, a strip steak, or even a filet mignon. It requires olive oil. Let me go back a moment. The quality of the meat must be excellent in order for you to get the best result for this particular recipe. Olive oil, kosher salt, fresh pepper, and garlic if so desired. And then grill it, sear it first, and then grill a steak like that approximately 18 to 20 minutes. And that will be definitely crisp on the outside because the oil will adhere to the fire and make it crisp. And that's why you have to keep turning it quite frequently. And it'll be crisp on the outside and definitely rare in the middle. Same way I would cook that hamburger that I spoke to you about a minute ago.
But
when you're using high-quality beef, the less you put on it, the better it's going to be.
Yeah.
Well, now let me take a slightly different tack then, because now I'm on a later page, three-pepper pomegranate skirt steak. Now here you're flirting with rather a large number of ingredients.
Well, skirt steak is different. Skirt steak does not have the tenderness that a strip steak or a porterhouse or a rib or cowboy steak does. It requires a little marinating and a little help to become soft. Then we add some of the ingredients to break down some of the tendons in there to make it a little bit softer and give it a little bit more of the flavor that it requires.
Yeah, I took the last time we did
that was chewy. It tasted fine. But it was
no,
chewy.
What was it? It was London broil. I got a piece of London broil, and I actually put off cooking it another day, so I marinated it for 3 days.
It's still
in red wine and balsamic vinegar mostly.
Yeah, well, the vinegar should have softened it up a little bit. Did it help any?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still chewy.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean,
it breaks down the enzyme, and then again, it changes the flavor and the taste of the meat.
Yeah, this is true.
Not always is it the flavoring that you add to it. I personally love the meat taste and the meat flavor.
Yeah, well, that's what do you think of this craziness over Kobe beef?
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. There's Kobe beef and there's Wagyu beef. The Kobe being the original Japanese-type beef that we hear so much about that's $100 and $200 and $300 a pound.
Right.
The only problem is with Kobe beef, it's so rich in texture. You have the content of meat in the eye is about 20% meat, 80% fat.
Oh, my.
That's what makes it so soft and flavorful. And we use it here in the States and in Japan. They use it merely as a tasting, not as a meal. Because when you eat...
You wouldn't want to sit there and eat a whole thing.
You couldn't absorb it. You're not going to feel too good if you eat a whole steak.
So you're saying it's just too much.
It's too rich. Yes. It's too rich. On the other hand, there's Wagyu beef, which is our complement to their Kobe beef here in the States. And your listeners out there may well find a huge difference in price in Kobe beef, in Wagyu,
Wagyu
beef.
Which means, means cow, I think, in Japanese.
Sorry?
I think Wagyu just means cow in Japanese.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what it is. In Japanese, it's cow, I think.
Yeah, they also grow it in Australia. I just discovered somebody's...
The original Wagyu beef from Australia goes to Japan to produce their Kobe beef.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Again,
going back to the Kobe beef for one more minute... The Wagyu beef is graded not like we grade ours now, which is prime, choice, and select. It's graded in numbers from 1 to 13, 1 being on the cheaper end and the less costly, and 13 being on the very, very, very best end. And sometimes, and the difference in quality between the two, the number 1 would be a choice to our specifications, and number 13 would be close to a Kobe.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes you see a Kobe hamburger, a Wagyu hamburger, at a third of the price in one place and another place. It's not because one is just cheaper than the other. One is much better than the other.
Well, what was the one we had that was not only Kobe beef, but it had foie gras on it? Where was that?
Oh, that was in London. It was at a place called L'Etranger in Chelsea in London.
I mean, you talk about rich.
That was fabulous.
That's enough to send you to a doctor.
I just have to go over this cookbook some more, because you might think, well, it's all about steaks and hamburgers, and I know all about how to cook those. But when you get to grilled venison loin steaks...
That's tricky. You've
got a different proposition altogether, and you need instruction.
Absolutely.
We've got rabbit with urban mustard right here, spicy marinated
rabbit.
Grilled rabbit, some absolutely beautiful pictures of some quail. So there's almost nothing in this whole array of meat that isn't covered in this book.
You might
what
be
a
interested.
Father's Day gift.
Pardon?
I said, what a Father's Day gift.
There you go. That's a very, but I,
very good note.
Yeah, the neat part about it is I already have my copy, so I get something else for Father's Day. But seriously, folks, the only things I grill that aren't in this book and that aren't beyond my wildest imaginings to cook on my grill is fish, because you don't do fish.
Fish?
Yeah, I guess.
What is that?
We don't do that, right?
I'm getting signals that we have to take a break right now. So why don't we hold off giggling about fish until the break?
That's fine.
We'll take a break now. Hang around there, Stan.
I will. Thank you.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding. An old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at. And I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
It's Saturday. You and your wife take the boys to the mall, straight to the food court. Your wife and Pete head for tacos. You and Danny want Chinese. You look up at the menu for a few seconds. You look down to see what Danny wants. But you don't see Danny. Your eyes dart around frantically. You instinctively call out,
Danny! Danny!
From the taco place, you hear a voice.
Hey, Dad! Change my mind!
Every parent knows that feeling when, even for a few seconds, you lose sight of your child. Imagine if he or she were actually abducted. Go to wirelessamberalerts.org. Sign up for free Amber Alerts on your cell phone. When an Amber Alert is issued in the areas you've chosen, you'll receive a free text message. If you spot the vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We've been talking to Stanley Lobel. Is it Lobel or Lobel?
Lobel.
Lobel, who's the preeminent butcher located in New York City, talking about his book, Lobel's Primetime Grilling, The Ultimate Guide for Serious Grillers and Meat Lovers, published by Wiley, which you can order from On the Menu.
www.onthemenuradio.com and go to the bookshelf.
Right.
And you'll find it there.
And then as it's an interesting intersection, after Stanley has been describing in mouthwatering terms abundance of meat and fowl, we have another caller on our other line who's going to be talking to us about hunger relief. I'm tripping all over my tongue today. Debbie Shore, who's calling from headquarters in D.C. Are you, Debbie?
Yes.
I never know how far along people are in their understanding of what the Share Our Strength does. Could you, first of all, state the case for us? People are always so shocked at the statistics.
Sure.
Why do we need anti-hunger relief?
Right. Well, there's about 30 million Americans currently that suffer from hunger in America. And our focus now is around ending childhood hunger. So there are about 12 million children out of that 30 million that are what are considered food insecure, don't have enough food during any given month to eat well and to be secure. So our focus now, when we first started, we were focused generally on hunger and poverty, and we still care very much about that. But our vision for the next 20 years, because we're about 20 years old, a little bit over that, is to end child hunger in America. And when we reached out to the culinary community, it was just sort of a natural connection that we thought would resonate with the chefs, and it does. Chefs feed people for a living, and they care very much about making sure people eat and having good nutrition. And with all the other causes that they support, which are hundreds, really so very many, Share Our Strength is always one of the organizations that's top of mind for the chef community.
Now, you're focusing just a part of the operation to the
child hunger. Well, we still support hunger relief in general, which would be supporting funds to local food banks and things like that. Organizations that supply emergency food.
Yeah, but our new vision
really is to focus very explicitly and very specifically on ending child hunger. So making sure that we support organizations that are providing access to nutritious food where children either go to school, where they live, where they pray, because a lot of these are in faith-based organizations, and where they play, which would be, rec centers and summer community programs.
Oh,
so the four areas that we focus on are where they live, where they go to school, where they play, and where they pray.
Now, you and your brother, who are, I always mention, Pittsburgh raised, born and raised. Yeah. Established this, you said, Share Our Strength 25 years ago?
We were founded at the end of 1984, essentially 1985, so
okay.
We're 23 years old, 24 years old.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is, and yeah, we're both natives of Pittsburgh.
Yes. We also heard that you have this, I didn't know you had a humanitarian award, but I do know that Floyd Cardos, Chef Floyd Cardos of Tabla in New York City, received it this year. What is this award, and who gets it, and why Floyd?
Yeah, this award is really something that we decided needed to be kind of highlighted because of so many of the chefs do extraordinary amounts of work for the organization. Floyd, who has always been supportive once he started with Danny Meyer's organization in New York, and he's the chef of Tableau Restaurant, and as you know, he'll be the guest chef at the Pittsburgh event. He just kind of, really took the organization to heart. He came with us on a trip to New Orleans, Louisiana, and he's just become really very committed from that trip, and he has special interest in helping the shrimping industry, which was hit terribly by the storm in Louisiana. So, you know, he got his restaurant and Union Square Hospitality Group, all the restaurants, to raise money for this issue, and they feature Louisiana shrimp on the menu, and, you know, he also worked with getting other restaurants around the Northeast involved, and has a special sort of fill in line at his restaurant for the guests at, to fill in line on the guest checks to support Gulf Coast restaurant workers, and he raised additional money.
Wow.
And he's just kind of really taken this very personally and very much to heart, and has just become just a tremendous supporter, and uses his business and his personal life and his environment to really make a difference.
Oh. And Floyd is going to be on our next program.
Yeah, he is.
I believe.
Yeah.
But more importantly, and something that we shouldn't let slip by, because there's a reason why Debbie's on the program today, because this is the season where across the nation there are events called Share Our Strength. Taste of the Nation, where communities across the entire United States have fundraisers which are supported by chefs and restaurants who volunteer their time and their ingredients, put on a fabulous strolling supper party type event. They're not all on the same day, Debbie, but they are happening around this time, I think. Am I correct?
That's right. They, if you can believe it, they actually started all in one day many years ago. But because we have so many events now, they're spread throughout the spring. The majority of them are in April, but they also go into May, as the one in Pittsburgh is, and a little bit into June as well.
Now, is there a central place where people in cities around the country can go to find out when the program is in their community?
Yes, they can log on to our website, which is www.strength.org.
But for local listeners, a special treat. The event is at the William Penn, the Omni William Penn Hotel. The date, sweetheart, is?
The date is May 16th.
Oh, I was
the
just
Grand Ballroom.
Okay.
I was you're a sweetheart.
I can call you a sweetheart, too, but I was actually referring to Anne. And the best treat of all is that Chef Floyd Cardoz is going to be the guest chef for that event. So
yeah, and some of the ones I have lined up here: Bigelow Grill, Cafe Zao, the Carlton Casbah, Dish, one of my favorite places.
But if you're within hundreds of miles of Pittsburgh and not as close to New York, you should come to Pittsburgh for this event, because Floyd's going to cook up a storm.
And what's the next one? What happens after Pittsburgh, Debbie?
Oh, I have that. We have so many. Let me just
I know.
In here. Sorry.
That's okay. I shouldn't have sprung that on you, because I wouldn't.
All right. I actually brought the listing.
Yeah.
They're just all over the country. The one after May 16th would be Hartford, Connecticut is May 24th.
Yeah. They just have to go on your website.
New York is May 23rd.
And get the whole thing. The 23rd, Stanley, did you hear that? New York?
Yeah, May is New York is May 23rd at the Roseland Ballroom.
Are you involved with that? Yeah. Now,
really?
And you know the Union Hospitality Group.
Union Square.
I mean Union Square Hospitality Group, don't you?
There's
Stanley.
Nothing more satisfying than helping children.
Yeah.
This is great stuff. And not only that, it's a good time. So it's a feel-good, and at the same time, it's a good time. It's a great cause. And so listeners locally, be sure to come and say hello to us, because we're going to be there on May 16th. And if you're too far away to come to Pittsburgh, go to the website to find out where the event is in a community you can reach, and go there and get involved.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Debbie, I thank you very much for taking the time and to call us. And
thanks so much. I wish I could be there next year.
Oh, okay.
So
your brother actually came one year.
Yes. We've both been to the event over the years, but neither one of us can make it this year, but we'll be back.
Well, we've got Floyd. I mean, I have a great crush on Floyd.
He's fantastic, yeah.
So I will endure, but we'll look forward to seeing you then
so
next
much.
Year. Thank you,
great.
Debbie.
Alrighty.
Bye.
Now, Stanley's still here. Stanley, let's do your website again.
www.lobels.com.
And hang in when we go to the next break, and we'll arrange when we're going to get together when we're in New York.
Fine.
Because we missed that.
Yeah, one question I haven't had a chance to ask him is, what is he doing about grass-fed, or what's he thinking about the movement for grass-fed, locally grown, organic, blah, blah?
That's exactly right, blah, blah.
See, I like grass-fed beef.
Well, it's something new. It's the grass-fed animals are not as flavorful as corn-fed animals, and what most of the people out there are doing now, except for the small individual ones, are feeding them on grass and then finishing them on corn to give the flavor and the quality of the animal that it needs to have a good taste and flavor.
Now,
if you eat straight grass-fed beef, you'll find it's a little bit on the tough side.
Stanley,
have you had it?
Stanley,
yes,
that,
I've
yeah,
had it. But it's local, too, is the other thing I was talking about, is because of all the...
if it's local, then it's then the odds are it's exactly what they say it is. And, again, it's... what was your experience?
I mean, I like it. The thing is that it's two things. One, it's very... I mean, we used to be able to buy whole sides of beef, but we're down to two people. And you can't just buy prime cuts because, I mean, if everybody just wants prime cuts, the farmer can't produce.
Yeah, the price goes through the roof.
And the other thing is the cost of it. It's very expensive, yeah.
I had a slightly different question. We travel to England a lot, Stanley. You can probably guess one of the reasons why in my accent. But there's a trend over there to local breeds. So there's a special red, Devon breed, and there's a Lake District breed, and there are several of the specialized, if you like, heirloom breeds, which are grown by local farmers, and the restaurateurs really seem to like them. Is anything like that happening in the U.S. or is
nothing?
No, nothing like that.
We have some people that started to do that. But we're not able to sell their product at a premium in order to satisfy their needs to get a little bit more for it because of the special attention and care that it's been giving the animal.
Okay.
But they're doing it with pork. Yeah, they're doing it with Berkshire.
And being very successful, I might add. That's because prior to these new breeds of pork, there was nothing else out there but the norm, which was sometimes good and sometimes lousy.
Oh, I thought it was mainly didn't even taste like pork.
Right, exactly. Well, it depends. You know, again, it varied so dramatically that you weren't sure what the heck you were getting after a while.
Yeah, and I have another question for you. Why do I keep coming up with these things?
You know, I don't know. It's your job, I guess.
Yeah, we've spent so much time in Europe, and nobody blinks an eye over horse meat.
But they do here.
Here, I have people go, we've had billboards that say, keep our horses in the stable, not on the table. You know, I mean, what do you think there's something innately evil about eating horse meat?
Well, yeah, I think it's just the word horse meat.
So what else are you going to call
it? For example, if anybody would try rattlesnake, a rabbit who's not used to it, and they would just eat it, they would find that it would be very flavorful and good. Once they knew what they were eating, their face would turn color.
Yeah, well, we've had kangaroo in Australia and
right.
Yeah, and
you're in the food business, and you know you have an open mind.
But the average
person would say, "I've got a horse steak for you."
But we eat Bambi and Peter Cottontail all the time.
Okay,
why should horses be excused?
Do you think we'll ever get to a time where horse meat will enter the food chain?
Not in the States.
Never.
It's quite prevalent in Italy. I mean...
Yes. We had some once called Grand Prix.
Well, as long as after you eat a good horse steak, you don't whinny, it's okay.
our thought was that if it was really Grand Prix, then it never would have been caught.
Well, you know, again, it depends on the quality of it. It depends on how it's prepared. Because we had it in, like, a very rustic place. It was not very good, but we had it in a fine restaurant, and it was altogether different.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Anyhow, you've been a great sport. So
you've had some great questions.
we have a lot of information.
Yeah, and hang in with us in the break so we can make our arrangements, and we'll go to a break now.
I will. Thank you.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial-up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers. Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
It all happened so fast. It was loud and scary, and I was trapped.
Katie is a kindergarten teacher in Pennsylvania. She was a passenger in a car struck head-on by a reckless driver.
That's when I met my guardian angel. His name is Sean, and he's a paramedic. Sean was there for me when I needed him. He knew just what to do, and he knew the right things to say.
Choose a career in emergency medical services. Call toll-free 877-PA-MEDIC. That's 877-PA-MEDIC.
Pennsylvania needs more guardian angels. I had mine, and he made all the difference.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.
Well, On the Menu's had quite an exciting show today.
Already.
We're going to get a tour of a meat market next time we're in Manhattan, which I love markets. And we have now some more interviews for our listeners. Do you want to introduce Windsor Court?
This is a fascinating place. It's called the Windsor Court Hotel. You wouldn't even know it was a hotel. You would walk by it on the street. The entrance is so discreet. And it's like a step back in time because it's decorated in the fashion of the 1920s, 1930s England with all the kinds of things that you might expect in a castle like Windsor Castle, which is obviously where the name came from. It's a very fine hotel owned and operated by Orient Express Hotels. What's recognized as one of the best dining rooms in New Orleans for the longest time. A number of the top chefs in New Orleans today started their careers cooking in the kitchen at the Windsor Court, and we had the opportunity to visit there for dinner. We even went back and did some interviews, and they insisted on feeding us lunch afterwards. So here we go at the Windsor Court Hotel in New Orleans.
I love the place.
We love the place.
On the Menu is at a luxurious, cutting-edge and grandeur hotel called Windsor Court Hotel in New Orleans, or New Orleans, I guess it's supposed to be. And we're talking to executive sous chef Brett Bro, who I hope will give us some of the background of this hotel that looks like it's been here forever but wasn't founded or opened until 1984, and also bring us up to speed on what's happened since Katrina and where are we now.
Okay, well, first off, good evening, everybody, and welcome. Thanks for having us on the show. The Windsor Court opened in 1984 and has been housing some of the top celebrities, more of the famous, more of the top-end clientele from around the world, actually. Since Katrina, we actually opened the hotel 4 weeks after Katrina, and we're the first luxury hotel to reopen in the city of New Orleans. We have been working diligently to try to restaff the hotel. We've been open a little about a year plus, and we are almost reaching the first hotel in New Orleans to be without temporary staff. We have come a very long ways. We're very proud of the hotel. We're very proud of the mystique, and we've pretty much brought all of the a la carte, all of the services are back in full swing. When we opened after the hurricane, the services were very limited. And we now have a la carte breakfast, a la carte lunch. We have suite service 24 hours a day. And we're now doing the dinner. We're redoing the dinner menu also. But it's fully operational.
Now, you were saying that you actually initially took in people, New Orleans natives, that were displaced, losing their property.
Absolutely. Well, after the, as many people in the pretty much across the world saw, a lot of people lost a lot of everything they owned. And we have, New Orleans is a very wealthy city. There's a lot of people with a lot of wealth here. And a lot of the more of the wealthier people lost a lot of their homes, and they came to stay with us. And actually, some people lived with us for 6, 7, 8 months, some of them almost 10 to 12 months until they got their homes rebuilt.
You have every conceivable variety of luxury here, from the linens and the crystals. You have, what, the Polo Lounge, and then you have, I don't remember when the name was changed. It used to be the Grill Room, and now it's the New Orleans Grill as your restaurant. Linens, just magnificent everything. And you're particularly renowned for tea. Could you tell us about your tea service?
Well, you know, I guess with the Windsor Court being the English, we do a very large tea service here. The mystique of the hotel almost revolves around what we do with tea here. Tea is very large. In the month of December, we did approximately a little over 6,000 people for tea. We were doing tea 7 days a week. We do tea 5 days a week now. We were doing it 3 days a week, and now we're up to 5 days a week. There is a very large demand for it, and even through the off-season, we still do quite a bit amount of tea, an average of 150 a day.
Can you name some names? Are you going to drop names for us or some of your clientele?
Well, I will say just in the last 7 months that I've been here, I fed the Prince of Norway. I fed Prince Albert, Queen Elizabeth's son. I fed our commander-in-chief, actually stayed with us. A lot of the musicians, a lot of the athletes. We house the opposing team for the Hornets. We take care of most of the bands that come. Anybody that almost anybody that's famous comes.
And the staff is discreet and the place very private, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous property. How does someone find it? How about a website?
You can go. We do have a website, WindsorCourtHotel.com. We are located right off of historic Canal Street. We're only one block off of Canal Street. And we're right next to the river and right next to the famous Harrah's Casino. Very easy to find, very centrally located.
Well, thank you for talking to us.
Certainly my pleasure. Thank you for having us.
We're going to move on to discuss the extraordinary wine cellar and resources that we have at the New Orleans Grill. We're talking now to Matthew Wilson, who is the manager of the Grill, and he put together some really exciting wine choices for us. He's very good at this. Tell us a little bit of the history, how you got such a spectacular collection, which are now, I believe, is like 10,000 bottles.
Well, we've been here since 1984, like Brett said, and we have bought collections from other from private owners in the past. Currently, we hold on to some of the older vintages that we have. We have a large selection of both Bordeaux and Burgundy, very high-end Burgundy, many of the Domaine Romanée-Conti collection. We have several vintages, very deep, and they're very expensive. But then we like to provide our guests that aren't necessarily into the most expensive wine on the list. We like to keep some lower end values, and so we constantly update the wine list and try to keep it fresh with newer selections that we, you know, keep New World wines and some other things that we like to keep the menu broad for our guests. You know.
I saw on one of the bits of information that you sold one bottle for $18,500. Is that the highest?
That is probably the highest that I've ever seen. I was here when that bottle was here years ago, 7 years ago, and I think it sold about a year after I left here, which was making about 6 years ago, I think it sold. But one of the prizes of the cellar. It was a double magnum Petrus, a 61 Petrus. And so, but we do have other nice selections still in our cellar, not quite that expensive, but that is the most expensive wine we've sold in recent times. We regularly sell higher end wines, you know, $800 to $1,000 bottle wines often. And we have some as high as $3,000 or $4,000 in the cellar currently. Some of them may even be underpriced and considered values at those prices. So we're very proud of the cellar, and we continue to improve it. Like I said, we enjoy updating the occasion.
Now, you like some small boutique-y vineyards, too. Do you actually travel around meeting these winemakers?
I've done some travel in the past. I've been to Napa Valley and Sonoma County as well, and I've been to Italy and done some travel there in some wine country, particularly the Montepulciano area. I love the Italian wines, and you know, I've done a little time in France, but didn't get to spend as much time in the vineyards as I like. But I do plan to go back soon. I have a great interest in trying different varietals from around the world, and so I try to travel as much as I can and see what I can, you know. And I would love to spend some time in the vineyards. Most wine makers are really big on the soil. And the planting of the grapes are great wine only comes from great grapes. So you can't have great wine without great grapes. That's my attitude, you know. So it really all begins on the plantation, you know, on the farm, you know.
Do you have any particular personal favorites?
Particular personal favorites. I like a lot of different wines. If I had to choose one grape varietal, I guess is the best way to say, I would probably go with Pinot Noir. But there's sometimes when a Cab, there's nothing that's going to be better than a Cabernet, you know. There's a lot of people that love Pinot Noir, and I am one of those. But it's hard to pick between those two. If I was on a deserted island, I might have to take a Cab, you know. You could just bring one bottle. But generally, I probably drink more Pinot Noir.
And are you a believer in this that you have to have a specific glass for each wine?
A specific glass for each wine. You know, we have varied glassware here, of course, for different receptacles for different wines. And I think it's important to have the correct glassware for wine. But if I'm drinking it personally, I'm more of a simple guy. I'll drink out of anything as long as it's not a rock glass, you know.
Your shoe.
That's right. Shoe. As long as the wine's good. No, I'm not too picky about my personal glassware, but we try to provide, top of the line, we use Schott's Wiesel is the name of some of our glassware, as well as some other top brands, German-made, you know, fine glassware.
Well, we certainly had a wonderful time, and thank you for the wine choices. And we didn't get around to specifying those today, but thank you, because we certainly enjoyed it, and thank you for talking to us.
My pleasure. I hope you enjoyed everything.
We're moving on now to the food at the Grill at Windsor Court, talking to Benjamin Doolittle. Oh, I screwed that one up. Benjamin Doolittle, who's a restaurant chef. Now, Benjamin, we're kind of in a little state of transition here, and I want you to just sort of explain where we're coming from in the kitchen, where the kitchen's going, and also talk about some of these delightful dishes that we've had and that you're planning to serve.
Well, currently in the restaurant, we are without an executive chef. So I've kind of taken on the role of you know, watching the cuisine and working with the food that goes out from the restaurant and also from sweet service. So it's mostly my job to make sure that we're maintaining the quality of cuisine that people at the Windsor Court Hotel are expecting. Currently, we just switched to a new a la carte lunch menu. Some of the dishes that we're doing on this new menu include baked scallops and their shell with truffle butter and baby vegetables, as well as a curried grouper corbillon with a curry mussel emulsion. It's served with caramelized baby vegetables, and it's quite a lovely dish. And then we're also working on some new dishes in the PM grill room, like port wine marinated venison and monkfish puttanesca dish that I'm currently working with.
Oh, that's great. Let me say, maintaining quality, the quality was just absolutely superb. What kind of things do you prefer working with?
Most of my influence is, you know, Southern cuisine, and I like to do a lot of the Cajun and Creole cuisine because that's, you know, those are my roots. But I've also worked with chefs from around the world. Jonathan Wright was from England. I've worked with Hartmut Henke from Germany. So I've got a good bit of a European influence as well, but I like to stick with the traditional Southern style of cooking.
Yeah, so basically you summarized it to me earlier that you're moving from what had been like a California-influenced cuisine to stronger influences from New Orleans, right?
Yes. Our previous executive chef had a very California sort of Asian influence. The food was very good, but it didn't quite go over well with the local public, and so we felt we needed to get back to our roots, back to the local flavors, the Southern and the Cajun and Creole traditions.
Now, where did you grow up?
I actually was born right across the lake in a little town called Mandeville, just 24 miles away. I'm a local boy. I've been here all my life.
And I understand that some of the products have already come back. Not the oysters yet. Are they back?
Well, most of our Louisiana seafood is back. Oysters are. We can get 365 days a year now. They're just as good as they used to be. crawfish are in season now, so all of our seafood is back, all of our local ingredients are back, and so we're ready to start moving on.
Well, I would like to actually eat here every night and trace your progress. Thank you for cooking so well.
You're very welcome. I'm glad to have you.
Was that fun or what?
Oh, we always have fun.
We do. This is such a crazy place. It was opened in 1984. It looks like it was opened in 1924.
It does. And we'll go back and revisit that next week, maybe. But right now, I hear music coming.
You hear music coming, so we must say, listeners, we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.